KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Scott King.
And I'm Joe Tursty. We host the KBOO podcast, the King Tursty Music Hour. Every month we upload a new show to our KBOO website. We currently have over 80 shows available for you to listen and enjoy.
Each of our shows is based on a different theme. Enjoy great music as well as our discussion of the songs and artists. Our show is rock, soul, and blues based, but you might hear anything, including country, jazz, and classical.
The easiest way to find us is to simply enter King Tursty Music Hour into your web browser and select it with the KBOO FM extension. That's King, K-I-N-G, Tursty, T-U-R-S-I, Music Hour.
While you're there, check out our wide variety of shows. We've got shows on social issues, musical themes, people, the holidays, and so much more.
That's the King Tursty Music Hour on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Haiti in shambles and thousands of Haitians on the run. Armed death squads now control nearly 90% of that country. And an extraordinary week of violence in the occupied Gaza and the West Bank. This week's newscast from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barrows Friedman reports on the ongoing and expanding violence and the continuing deadly Israeli drone attacks on civilians in Gaza. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and coming up later on in the broadcast, we'll be going back to Gaza. The things that are happening around the ground are unbelievable and extremely troubling. We're going to keep an eye on that, and we're also going to expand our coverage of the West Bank, because that's the next Gaza, eight times the size of Gaza, and the Israelis, they're soldiers by day, settlers by night. And the situation on the ground is desperate. We've got information for you on that as well. But first of all, we welcome back to these airwaves our senior producer, Kevin Pina. Kevin Pina is an expert on all things Haiti, has spent many years in and out of the country, was there through, I believe, through two U.S.-sponsored coups, and the suffering that continues to accrue from U.S. policy and domination is also hard to explain. Kevin, welcome back to Flashpoints. We know in one moment we're going to be joined by somebody who has a lot to worry about. We're going to have an anonymous visit, if you will, from Joseph. That will be his name de guerre. Kevin, set the scene for us, please.
Well, as you said, 90% of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, is said by the United Nations to now be under the control of the paramilitary death squads, which call themselves, ironically, Vive Ensemble, which in Creole means live together, while, of course, they are burning their way through the country, through the capital. On July the 7th, there were more massive attacks in Kenskoff and in Latibonite, which is the breadbasket of Haiti. So it's expanding beyond the capital now, their control and their grip on the country. It's interesting. There's a cycle that seems to be coming together, which is that, the gangs, the paramilitary death squads, these gangs called Vive Ensemble, they every 1 to 3 weeks they launch these offensive, they take over territory, they hold it. Then we see these press reports of these counterattacks by the police, but the police never seem to be holding territory. In the meantime, there are many honest police officers who do not support the gangs, while There are some that we understand are still within the police department who are supporting the gangs. And there is also fear that there are some members of the CPT, the so-called Transitional Presidential Council, that behind the scenes also are in some way supporting the gangs. This is the perception of a large part of the public. But it's interesting, this give and take. But despite the press of these offensives by the police, it always seems to be the paramilitary death squads that continue to capture and hold territory while the Haitian government continues to lose it. And then part of the cycle is, once that occurs, then they go hat in hand back to the international community and they claim that they need more aid. At the same time, we've got to remember that hundreds of millions of dollars continue to pour in to an ever-expanding payroll of the Haitian government, to the Haitian National Police, to the so-called multinational mission known as the MSSM, which is led by the Kenyan forces on the ground, police forces on the ground, and to BINU, the United Nations mission on the ground in Haiti. So there's this cycle that I've seen occur many times. The Vive Ensemble death squads take over territory. The police have these huge counteroffensive, which the press touts and says, oh, you see, they're doing something. Then the Haitian government says, you know, we went from 50% of the capital lost to them, 60% lost to them, 70% lost to them, 80% lost to them, now 90% lost to them. And at every one of those announcements, you then also see the international press say, oh, Haiti needs more aid or they're going to lose the capital. So it really begins to resemble more of a cycle and a process where the government and the international community need the gangs, because it's the justification for continuing to support what clearly is not working.
Hey, in the meantime, you know, Kevin, we know that this just recalls, and your experience is crucial here. I mean, I can remember way back, you thought you were going to the presidential palace to celebrate the election of a duly elected president, but you were ended up in the crossfire of a coup, right? The people's will have been undermined and cast aside for decades. Of course, as you know, because you watch these things happen on the ground, U.S. support for coup and the kind of... And before you tell us about our guest, what kind of weaponry are these death squads holding the Capitol hostage with? What kind of weapon? Where is it made? What is it?
Well, huge armaments, and they're clearly coming from the United States. How they're getting in, I don't know. The United States can stop Haitians who are fleeing the violence and the hellscape that they helped to create, but they can't seem to stop the flow of guns going into that country. And you know, just remember that many Haitians, and oftentimes myself, this pattern that I've described to you often seems as if it's designed to provoke a U.S. military intervention to justify U.S. Marines boots on the ground. And let me give you another example. Recently on social media, one of the gangs inside of Haiti is called the Taliban Gang. And they released a video on Haiti's social media that showed them in Indianapolis shouting chants supporting the death squads in Haiti while they were firing off weapons in a shopping center in Indianapolis, Indiana. And clearly that is meant as a provocation under these circumstances of the Trump administration. And let's not forget that it's already managed to justify and sort of sweep under the carpet the fact that Eric Prince of Blackwater fame and his new company are already there. They're the ones who have been doing these so-called kamikaze drones with the Haitian police that have had some success but have stopped because of the number of civilians who are in those areas who are also being killed and maimed by those kamikaze drones. But again, it seems as if the paramilitary death squads, their game from the beginning has been to provoke a U.S. intervention. And now when you see the gang, distributing on social media, spreading on social media footage of them in Indianapolis, that's another provocation, again, to frighten not only Haitians, but now they're going to frighten, Trump's MAGA base in this environment that he's created against legal immigrants and, this whole frightening environment that he's created for people who are here. I mean, you know what's going on. You've reported on it many times about how now even naturalized U.S. citizens can lose their citizenship if they're caught in a crime or something that's considered untenable by the Trump administration and by Homeland Security. So there seems to be a larger game at play here if you look at it over the last 2 years. And yes, I think our guest is going to have a lot to say about this. Let's welcome him on now. Joseph is now in one of the areas, is managed to be in one of the areas that is not controlled by the paramilitary death squads in Haiti, Vivre Ensemble, the so-called gang paramilitary death squads. He's in that 10% that's left, that's still under the control of the Haitian National Police. Now, remember, many of these neighborhoods that are that 10% that are left, one of the reasons they're there is because there are these so-called vigilance brigades, self-defense community brigades that are fighting the Vivre Ensemble coalition, the gang coalition, tooth and nail, right? Vastly outgunned, many times with just handguns against powerful automatic weapons. These guys are defending that last 10%. Now, they've received some support from some honest police on the ground, but it's not enough, and the government has never embraced it because it's really clear they're more afraid of the people than they are of Vivre Ensemble, because, as I said, it's almost as if they need them, because if Vivre Ensemble wasn't there, the paramilitary death squad gangs weren't there, they could not continue to keep the gravy train of aid flowing. They are now parasitically intertwined with each other, in a sense. So, Joseph, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you? So what did you think about my last statement there about the government and these paramilitary death squads sort of depending on one another? What did you think of that? What do you think of that sort of description I've given?
Yeah, I think that your point of view is reasonable, but me, from the way that I'm seeing it, I'm kind of being confused. It's because when you mentioned the self-defense brigade, normally they were supposed to be backing up the police, because they are not really trained, So in a police operation against the gang, they would be, backing up, covering if, some of the gang members are escaping. But now, what is going on in the operation from the ground information that I'm having? So, in the all those neighborhoods, Canapé Vert, Crissoua, they are arming those self-defense group, and they are putting them in front, And a lot of them are getting killed because, they are not well trained. And the police just come afterwards. So now I'm kind of feeling, confused of how they are using, the group that protects their neighborhood, because previously that wasn't the way that things were going.
All right, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's a voice of our guest's clandestine interview from one of the few remaining neighborhoods that is not under the control of the violent paramilitary gang death squads inside of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Well, that's interesting to say, because I think that there are also, you probably heard this from other folks, that there is suspicion that they're intentionally weakening the self-defense brigades by putting them on the front lines, not giving them proper arms, and letting them get killed as the front line of defense against Vivre Ensemble. Have you heard that argument as well?
apparently that's what it looked like, you know, because it wasn't that wasn't the way that they were operating, you know. Now we know that the most influential, let's say, neighborhood can appear here in Port-au-Prince, and I have to mention why it's so important. Because if you heard about what they, you know, where the gang, a lot of gang members coming from La Boule, were detained by a police officer in Canapé-Vert police station, and the population just burned them all. And that's why we start, for instance, with the expression in Creole, they say Bois-Calé. It's like when they find somebody that they even suspected that is a gang, they burn up. This neighborhood,
the vigilante justice.
This neighborhood is Canapé-Vert is very influenced, you know, in this movement. They were requesting support of the government, particularly the police, because, you know, they are protecting their neighborhood, but they are, let's say, downtown. The police was like, losing feet, losing territory. Since they were seeing, you know, that the gangs were coming close, they wanted to have support, but the support of the police, but not only being armed and now being put in the front. So I guess, you know, that's what it looks. It looks like they are weakening, because they are also, the government also is afraid of them. Because they are the one that can mobilize, you know, people, because the population is just tired of, you know, we most of us, we feel trapped, you know. As you mentioned, I'm in the neighborhood that is halfway from Port-au-Prince downtown and Pétionville, which is relatively a safe place. But from what I hear all the gunshots, you know, all the operations that they are doing at night when they are dropping those kamikaze bomb, you know, in those neighborhoods downtown. It's like you feel that it's coming up to you. So, and it's this sense that is frightening, you know, the people that are in this neighborhood, particularly in Canapé-Vert, that started the movement. They were making demonstrations, and the government was frightened by the amount of people, you know, that were on the street, and they finally wanted to cooperate. But now what they are doing, as I told you, is they are putting them in the front, and a lot of them are getting killed. And I think that, you know, their strategy now is to weaken this group of self-defense.
It's interesting you should bring that up, because I remember that there were protests in front of the Primature, which is the Prime Minister's bureau office, and there were a lot of people. And the police attacked that protest with tear gas, lots of tear gas, beat people, they shot at people. But yet the terrorist coalition, Vive Ensemble, has held several public demonstrations, and the police are never there. Is that right?
Exactly. You know, in the Carrefour neighborhood, you know, there are, let's say, thousands of demonstrators, you know, come, and it was the Tila police, one of the gangs in the area. He was, you know, he was safe working on the street with a lot of people. And the police, they don't approach this area. And this this is what's getting the people in Canapé, they are mad, and they are threatening, you know, to hit the road again in the coming weeks.
Well, just last week, Izzo, right, held a protest, right? Izzo held a protest in the capital just last week.
In Carrefour. Izzo doesn't show himself these days, because we are having some images of him, but we don't know, since whenever he's speaking, he's not providing, you know, the date on which, and he's kind of all around, you know, in social media, so we don't know, because they've reported that, you know, that he was wounded in one of his operations held by this special, let's say, the special task force that was that the CPT and jointly with the government set up, you know, to fight the gang with the support of the, let's say, private military company. I don't know the exact name that is linked to Eric Prince. So he's not sure. But Tilap Lee his mother and other gangs, you know, they publicly speak, you know, then they were publicly being, you know, walking down the street, making speeches at certain points, you know, and no police attended.
So all of this makes the population very suspicious of its own government at this point. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay, Kevin, can I jump in here for a second? It's Dennis Bernstein
Kevin
Pina. I welcome our guest, Namdegir Joseph. We appreciate the information and coming from on the ground. Can I ask you to talk a little bit more specifically about what this means in real terms? Are kids going to school? How is the population being shifted around in the context of this continuing, endless U.S. policy of destabilization as a way of control? We know Haiti is a resource-rich country, but it seems like poverty defines the day. So how does this look on the ground for people just trying to stay alive?
It's very difficult. And as you mentioned, for the school, there are neighborhoods where, you know, kids cannot go to school because they have moved. And now most of the school that we have in Port-au-Prince in particular, they, most of them, since some of them are, you know, related to some, let's say, religious, some churches, so they go to Pétionville and they share, you know, because those congregations, they have civil schools. So what they do, they share the space that they have of another school. If they had a school downtown, for instance, and they have one in Pétionville, so what they do, they share the same place together. The people that come downtown, you know, they come for a week while they are online. They are, you know, online with the other one in Pétionville, vice versa. That's the way that they do it. But some other, for some other categories, you know, they just cannot go to school because they don't have that option that some schools have, you know, and it's very difficult. Some of them have moved, they left the Port-au-Prince, you know, to go to school in, you know, in the countryside, on other cities. You know, the situation is not because some of them they come from other cities because everything is concentrated in Port-au-Prince. So it's very difficult and it's very frustrating because they don't see exactly where this thing is going. As Kevin mentioned, for instance, you have a solution. A joint solution between the government and the international community of bringing the MSS. So the MSS just got like a year when they are being here. They haven't, you know, the gangs have now more footprint in the capital and some cities in Artibonite than before the MSS was there. So this is where the frustration is coming. So you have all this money coming to back up the MSS. And I know that currently OES, OEA, they have the
Organization of American States.
They are mentioned that they are lacking 600 million, you know, in order to fulfill all of that they promised, you know, but still they are here, they have they are prepared, properly trained, and we don't understand how come they are here. We're working with the police. First of all, the government is hiring now, a private military company to help them. But how about the MSS that is there to help them? So we don't. This is kind of being confused, and it's feeling a lot of frustration. And economically, you know, since boats cannot come in Port-au-Prince, no plane cannot come from the U.S. And it's very difficult, you know, for food to come in Port-au-Prince. It has to go these days to Cap-Haitien, you know. So it's, I can say it's very difficult, and the population is very frustrated and confused, because we don't see where this thing is going. It's like we think that, you know, there's not the international community, particularly the U.S., nor the government, just having a strategy that we think that can resolve the situation. So that's what I can say. The people are suffering. Some people, they have to leave their house. Kids, not all kids are able to go to school. Some they have totally stopped. And they are, you know, when they go to, let's say, sort of camps or other neighborhoods that are not being in control of the gang, and they are not being fed well, they lack of water and everything. I just want to say it's frustrating.
Wow. Well, listen, Kevin, we have about 2 minutes left, a final sort of back and forth with our very courageous guest.
Well, I'm just wondering, Joseph, day-to-day life is hard, right, to get groceries. You know, I understand you guys just went through a blackout, right? There was no electricity for weeks on end because the Peleg, the dam, which provides most of the electricity to the capital, was also paralyzed by the people in the area, because they were protesting that nothing was really being done to stop the gangs from taking more territory, despite all of the hundreds of millions of dollars that have been pouring into Haiti, supporting the Kenyan police, the Salvadoran police, the Guatemalan police. I mean, they're all there. And as you said, yes, there's a sense that they're not really doing anything. How about just survival? It's hard, and you can't go to the bank, right? You can't. It's difficult to get money. Just give us a sense of how hard day to day life is for you and other people who are living in the capital today.
We have one minute for that, please.
Let's say it's very tense. You know, the flowing of goods is difficult in Port-au-Prince. So everything is very expensive, and sometimes we lack of some product. And the banks, it's not even easy to find money there, and they don't. The banks, they just their hour of operation is from 8 to 2, you know, and it's with the, for instance, dollar, you cannot find dollar because they are ordering all the stuff in dollar, and it's difficult to find dollar on the market. So it's like we are, day-to-day life, you'll be seeing people on the street because they have to find a way to try to feed their family. But it's everything is expensive. Even transportation is expensive because since RL, they raised the price of the gas, and even on the international market, it has lower, and it's not effective. So we are just struggling, and since the Haitians are very resilient, so this is why I think things have not exploded yet.
Right. Joseph, we urge you to be careful. We can't tell you how much we appreciate your courage and the information, because we never hear about what the real politics are on the ground. So this is so important to us. We hope you'll come back, you'll stay safe and come back, and we'll continue this dialogue. Of course, my biggest thanks also to Kevin Pina, senior producer here at Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, KPFA in the Bay Area. He's been on this beat for so many years. We thank you, Kevin. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. As we do every Thursday, we present the newscast from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman, and the situation on the ground in Gaza is desperate. By the way, we should say before we bring this to you that we're going to start a new segment. We're going to call it West Bank Watch, because what the Israelis are busy continuing in Gaza, they're now launching through the settler movement, you know, soldiers by day, settlers by night, and vice versa. So we're going to have a new segment. We're going to keep a spotlight on what's going on there. We need to watch that as well. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman. Listen.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barros Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 643 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombarded areas across Gaza this week, killing approximately 670 Palestinians and injuring more than 2,800 between July 2nd and July 9th, according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The Gaza Government Media Office stated on Monday, July 7th, that Israel had committed 59 separate massacres in 100 hours, killing nearly 300 people, 99 of whom were targeted by the Israeli army at U.S.-Israeli so-called aid distribution points. Today, on Thursday, the health ministry reported that Israel killed at least 82 Palestinians and wounded 247 in 24 hours. Earlier on Thursday, an Israeli drone strike in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza killed at least 13 people, mostly children and women, when they were lining up outside a volunteer-run charity to obtain food supplements. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum reported from the site of the massacre, saying that, quote, evidence of the strike is all around. This is a small but very deep hole in the ground resulting from the Israeli attack. You can see one of the shoes left by a Palestinian child, a shattered window in a nearby house. There are craters on the wall left by Israeli drone shrapnel. Reporter Moaz Al-Khalut reported from Gaza City on Monday, where attacks on the city and surrounding neighborhoods have been nonstop.
The ongoing Israeli airstrikes killed many Palestinians today. The last strike targeted a group of civilians in the center of Gaza City. I'm talking to you from Al Ahli Arab Hospital. While injured people arrived to this health facility on foot and by carts, and all of these who just arrived are receiving treatment on the ground. What struck me and what shocked me the most is to see a little child while taking his last breath on the ground here. I'm talking to you while there is a helicopter is opening fire on some point here or there. I'm not sure who
That was Moaz Al-Khalut. On Tuesday, Israel attacked the Burej refugee camp in central Gaza, killing and wounding Palestinian families as they slept. Just before 3 a.m., Israeli airstrikes hit tent shelters, engulfing the area in flames. A survivor told Al Jazeera that, quote, the attack felt like a ring of fire. These are school children. What is it about this school? There's nothing in it except children. It shelters only kids who have nowhere else to go. These drones are targeting nylon tents where people are simply trying to sleep. I honestly don't know why. Another displaced Palestinian who witnessed the attack said he and 10 others sleeping in a tent suddenly woke up to the sound of intense bombing and blinding lights. Quote, the explosions were so powerful that even our blankets were completely burned, he said. We started checking on the children and trying to make sure everyone was okay. My hands are still covered in soot as I've been trying to salvage whatever I can. On Wednesday, July 9th, Israel dropped an estimated 20 bombs on Gaza City's Tufah neighborhood, using heavy missiles that leveled buildings to the ground. A baby girl was pulled from the rubble in the aftermath of an attack also on Wednesday in central Gaza City. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Civil Defense, told reporters while holding the infant that, quote, the bombing was on a heavily populated house, the youngest of whom inside the building is this little girl, who is not even a few months old. Most or possibly everyone who was inside the apartment were injured or martyred. There is a woman martyr. We don't know if she was the mother of this child. In 90% of the bombings that are happening right now, it is these children who pay the price, who are targeted, killed, and injured.
لكن حقيقة المشهد صعب جدا أكثر من 20 إصابة بهذا الاستجداف الواقع صعب.
That was Mahmoud Bassal of the Palestinian Civil Defense. And Israel is issuing consecutive forced displacement orders, mostly in Gaza City and Khan Yunis. On Tuesday, the United Nations Humanitarian Office stated that, quote, even the smaller areas where people are being forced to concentrate, now down to about 15% of the strip and shrinking, are fragmented and lack the most basic infrastructure and services. Like the rest of Gaza, they remain extremely unsafe. Across the strip, families are trying to survive this nightmare, protect their children to the extent possible, and search for whatever minimal food exists, the UN said. Since mid-March, when Israel broke the ceasefire, the Israeli military has issued 54 displacement orders, placing about 297 square kilometers under displacement, 81% of the entire Gaza Strip, the UN says. In addition to the relentless airstrikes on Gaza, more than 770 Palestinians have been killed and more than 5,100 injured over the last 6 weeks, trying to obtain meager amounts of food aid at so-called distribution sites run by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, a joint Israeli-U.S. private mercenary company. This week, the GHF closed its only food distribution point in central Gaza, forcing tens of thousands of Palestinians to travel long distances toward the south of Gaza in search of food. Al Jazeera reporter Tariq Abu Azoum stated on Wednesday, July 9th, that GHF suspended operations at the central Gaza site without prior notice, adding to the danger and confusion of starving Palestinians risking their lives to access a box of food. Abu Azoum stated that, quote, the three aid hubs that remain operational are in the south, meaning that for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in central Gaza, the route to get aid will be a lengthy, dangerous trip on foot. This concentration of aid in the south corresponds to what Israel is outlining under its proposal for a so-called humanitarian city amid the ruins of Rafah, which would see the transfer of Palestinians from other parts of Gaza. Palestinians are saying they fear Israel might forcibly prevent them from returning, end quote. These broad daylight plans for forced relocation of Palestinians into concentration camps in southern Gaza are part of the Israeli government's vision that Prime Minister and war crimes fugitive Benjamin Netanyahu and top Israeli officials have been pitching to the Trump administration this week in Washington. Israel's war minister, Israel Katz, this week stated that the so-called humanitarian city would be built, quote, on the ruins of Rafah. The aim of the area would be to, quote, concentrate the population of Gaza and separate it from Hamas, Katz stated, adding that the Israeli government is looking into the possibility of partnering with an international entity to oversee its management. Katz encouraged, quote, voluntary migration of Palestinians to other countries and said the government wants to maintain a military presence in Gaza regardless of any ceasefire agreement. A source identified as an official familiar with the matter told Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz on Wednesday that, quote, the plan is essentially to move all civilian Gazans south to a large tent city in Rafah, where they will have hospitals and plenty of food. How did the prime minister put it? Give them Ben and Jerry's for all I care, the source said. The Israeli source said that Netanyahu is not ruling out the option of Israel running the compound set to be established in Rafah. Quote, when the construction of the city is completed and everyone or almost everyone has moved south, the question will arise as to who operates these zones, the humanitarian island, to be established in the south, the official said. The prime minister thinks that in the short term, we should not be afraid to do the job. According to Katz, Haaretz reports, the plan involves moving 600,000 Palestinians, primarily from the Al-Mawasi area, into the new zone after security screenings. Once inside, residents would not be allowed to leave. The defense minister added that if conditions permit, construction of the city would begin during the 60-day Israel-Hamas ceasefire currently under negotiation. A proposal seen by the Reuters news agency, notably bearing the name of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, described a plan to build concentration camps called humanitarian transit areas inside and possibly outside Gaza for Palestinians. Reuters reported that the $2 billion plan, quote, created sometime after February 11th and carrying the name of the U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF, was submitted to the Trump administration, according to two sources, one of whom said it was recently discussed in the White House. The plan, reviewed by Reuters, describes the camps as large-scale and voluntary places where the Palestinian population in Gaza could, quote, temporarily reside, de-radicalize, reintegrate, and prepare to relocate if they wish to do so. A slide deck seen by Reuters goes into granular detail on the humanitarian transit zones, including how they would be implemented and what they would cost. It calls for using the sprawling facilities to, quote, gain trust with the local population and to facilitate U.S. President Donald Trump's vision for Gaza. Reuters added that the U.S. State Department declined to comment on the proposal, with a senior administration official denying that anything of the sort is under consideration and claiming that, quote, no resources are being directed toward that end in any way. This week, the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights submitted a Freedom of Information Act request for documents related to the State Department's approval of $30 million in funding for the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. In its FOIA request, the major civil rights group says that it is seeking records that could reveal whether GHF was also created to further President Trump's Gaza Riviera ethnic cleansing plan. The Center for Constitutional Rights has previously joined other human rights and legal organizations in warning that individuals and entities involved in GHF could face legal liability for complicity in war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. At the same time, an investigation this week published by the Financial Times revealed that the Boston Consulting Group, quote, helped establish the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, modeled the costs of relocating Palestinians from Gaza, and entered into a multi-million-dollar contract to help launch an aid scheme for the shattered enclave. According to the investigation, the firm's team, quote, also built a financial model for the post-war reconstruction of Gaza, which included cost estimates for relocating hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the Strip and the economic impact of such a mass displacement. One scenario estimated more than 500,000 people in Gaza would leave the enclave with relocation packages worth $9,000 per person, or around $5 billion in total. The international aid group Save the Children said it had already cut ties with the Boston Consulting Group, but this week called the firm's role in Gaza utterly unacceptable. While people are killed every day at these U.S.-staffed killing fields masquerading at so-called aid sites, and as thousands of tons of food, medicine, fuel, and supplies remain trapped on the other side of Israeli crossings, just kilometers away, Palestinian children are dying of starvation and preventable, treatable diseases in hospitals that are quickly going dark. On July 5th, Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah, head of pediatrics and maternity at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, stated that fortified and specialized formula for premature or malnourished newborns is at severely low stocks. He was recorded inside the neonatal intensive care unit by journalist Bara Lafi.
Updating about neonatal ICU and the general condition in the hospital of Nasser Medical Complex. There is still shortage of milk, but there is a lot of volunteers who try to contact with us and try to help. They want to buy milk anyway from the local market and try to supply that milk for the hospital. But unfortunately, that milk is highly cost in its price, and the availability of this milk is a little amount.
That was Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at the Nasser Medical Complex on July 5th. On Wednesday, July 9th, the hospital administration issued a warning saying that Nasser's fuel supplies had run dry and it was entering, quote, crucial and final hours. With the fuel counter nearing zero, doctors have entered the battle to save lives in a race against time, death, and darkness, the statement read. They work in operating rooms without air conditioning, the boiling heat, their faces are sweating, their bodies are weary from hunger and fatigue, but their eyes are still burning with hope and determination. Medical teams fight to the last breath. They have only their conscience and hope in those who hear the call. Save Nasser Medical Complex before it turns into a silent graveyard for patients who could have been saved. Also on July 9th, journalist Abdelkader Sabah reported from the Al-Helu hospital, where the fuel shortage because of Israel's total blockade is threatening the lives of premature newborns whose incubators need electricity to run. As four tiny newborns lay in one incubator, Sabah says, quote, these children require immediate and continuous oxygen, in addition to nutritional supplements such as milk and other pharmaceutical supplements, which are scarcely available in the Gaza Strip. Dr. Munir Al-Bursh, the director of the Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza, stated that Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City is also facing power cuts due to the fuel shortage. He said on Tuesday, July 8th, that, quote, we repeat what we've said before. When fuel is denied to hospitals, the ventilator stops for a premature baby who suffocates in silence. A patient in intensive care suddenly loses their heartbeat and no one can save them. A wounded young man bleeds on the waiting bed while no operating room is functioning. Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, the director of Al-Shifa Hospital, reported that 13 intensive care unit patients, mostly on ventilators, about 100 babies in incubators, and 350 patients relying on kidney dialysis services are currently at risk because of the severe fuel shortage. He stressed that the hospital is already overwhelmed with hundreds of injured people and will no longer be able to perform surgeries. quote, operating rooms will shut down and we will not be able to treat the large influx of injured people. Our oxygen stations will also stop functioning, and a hospital without oxygen is no longer a hospital, he said. Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah announced on July 8th that the hospital's main generator broke down and spare parts were unavailable for its maintenance. And with the fuel shortage, hundreds of patients' lives are at risk. Meanwhile, meningitis cases are surging, especially in children, according to local healthcare workers and international aid organizations. Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, reported nearly 40 cases of newly admitted viral and bacterial meningitis in the last week. Al Jazeera said that in Gaza City, the pediatrics department at Al-Rantisi Children's Hospital recorded hundreds of cases in recent weeks. Hospitals still operating are overwhelmed with beds full and severe shortages of vital antibiotics. There is no space in the hospitals, said Dr. Mohammed Abu Magasib, the deputy medical coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza. There is no space to isolate. Airborne and life-threatening bacterial meningitis can spread in overcrowded tents, according to the WHO. Viral meningitis, though less serious, can easily spread in shelters with poor sanitation. The United Nations Humanitarian Office warned on Wednesday that, quote, in the north of Gaza, 10 water wells have stopped operating due to the shortage of fuel. Another 25 wells that are functioning only partially could also shut down soon. Shorter pumping hours, reduced water production, and limited solid waste collection provide fertile ground for diseases spreading, especially among vulnerable people, including children, older people, and pregnant women. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot a 14-year-old Palestinian boy in the northern city of Nablus on July 6th. The child, Iyad Abdul Muati Iyad Shalakti, succumbed to his injuries and died on July 9th, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. The group says that Iyad was with two of his friends on a hill in the Askar refugee camp when an Israeli military operation began. After their withdrawal, the military vehicles stopped at the bottom of the hill and shot around 7 bullets at the children from a distance of about 20 to 40 meters away. Iyad remained lying on the ground, bleeding for around 15 minutes, DCIP stated. When his friends tried to lift him, they were targeted again with around 20 bullets. The two children were injured, one in the right hand and the other in the foot. An ambulance arrived at the hill, took Iyad and transported him to Rafidia Hospital, where he was admitted to the emergency room. The doctors determined he had sustained multiple bullet wounds to his right flank, right foot, and abdomen, as well as shrapnel in both hands. Israeli forces have killed 32 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2025, according to documentation collected by DCIP. 206 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces and settlers in the West Bank since October 7, 2023, the group says. The United Nations reported that Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinian men on July 7th, also in the Nablus governorate, during a raid on a house, using loudspeakers to demand the surrender of a man wanted by the Israeli army. According to eyewitnesses, the man's father-in-law opened the door and was shot. A neighbor and relative who attempted to assist the injured man was also shot and killed. According to eyewitnesses, Israeli forces then opened fire, sent a drone into the house, and forced another Palestinian to enter the home to reportedly locate the wanted Palestinian, who was later found killed outside the house. His body was withheld by Israeli forces, the UN said. Meanwhile, house demolitions continue to accelerate around the West Bank. The Wafa news agency reported on Wednesday that Israeli forces carried out large demolition campaigns in Ramallah, Jerusalem, and Nablus, destroying at least 8 homes and 2 agricultural structures. Demolitions are ongoing in Tulkarem and Nur Shams refugee camps. Despite a recent injunction by the Israeli High Court temporarily freezing demolition orders, the UN says that Israel began destroying Palestinian homes in the two refugee camps on July 7th, targeting 104 residential buildings. In Nor Sham's camp, residents near the camp reported that a building was set on fire by Israeli forces within the area, the UN stated. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Heroic and Traumatized, a volunteer paramedic's story by Hend Abu Hello, writing from Gaza. Hend profiles a young paramedic who she calls Yusuf Ra'ed. He did not want to give his real name for fear that he and his family might become targets for Israel. Yusuf had been a volunteer paramedic with the Red Crescent since 2012, when he was just 14. He was one of the youngest volunteers in the history of the Red Crescent, he told Hend proudly. He and his wife and child had been displaced from Jabalia in Gaza's north, and though not on duty, Yusuf had no second thought about coming to Hend's father's rescue after Israel bombed the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza last August. Hend's father was trapped when a stairwell he was standing on collapsed in the airstrike. Hend writes, quote, "Medical professionals and emergency responders like Yusuf have all been particularly affected over the duration of Israel's genocide in Gaza. At least 1,400 have been killed, while 360 are detained. In December 2023, while working at the Red Crescent headquarters in Jabalia, which was doubling as both a medical center and refuge for displaced people, Yusuf was detained by Israeli troops along with dozens of others, including colleagues and displaced civilians. Blindfolded and handcuffed, he was transferred to the infamous Sidi Tayman detention camp, described as a torture camp by rights groups. They threatened to kill me constantly, Yusuf said. They even accused me of being a Houthi fighter. I kept pleading, I'm just a civilian, a first responder, but they didn't care. He said four soldiers then beat him up. Yusuf, who has chronic asthma, pleaded with the soldiers to stop. I started vomiting blood and gasping hard, Yusuf recounted, which he said only made them laugh. During one interrogation in early January, a soldier asked for his home address. Yusuf naively told the soldier. Hours later, the soldier told him, which turned out to be true, that they had bombed his house in Jabalia, where his wife, toddler son, and other relatives had been sheltering until the Israeli military ordered people to evacuate the north. I broke down, begging to know if my family had survived. They just laughed. We will kill everyone in Gaza, he said they told him. In another interrogation, they showed him a photo of his wife and son. If you don't give us what we want, we'll kill them, he said they told him. One click, that's all. He kept telling them that he was just a first responder and that he didn't have the information they were looking for, which, he said, was the location of the Israeli captives in Gaza or members of Hamas. In January 2024, Yusuf was released at Karam Abu Salem border crossing. Run, Yusuf said he was told. Run. If you stop, we'll shoot you. The first thing he did was call his brother, Abdullah, who informed Yusuf that their mother and four other siblings had fled to Rafah, while Yusuf's wife, son, and father remained trapped in the north. Those are excerpts from Heroic and Traumatized, a volunteer paramedic story by Hend Abu Hello, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. The camp's Breakers breakdance crew in Gaza hold regular dance and art classes for kids. And this week they hosted breakdance competitions with some of their students. That was from the Camps Breakers crew in Gaza. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
Does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is written and produced by Charlie Lang. For questions, comments, email Dennis Bernstein at dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and